Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rebecca Frere. I'm a Deputy State Public Defender appearing today on behalf of Mr. Akins. John Wigmore describes cross-examination as the greatest legal invention engine ever invented for discovery of the truth. Chief Justice Berger describes it as the principal means by which the believability of a witness and the truth of their testimony is tested. And Justice Scalia said the Confrontation Clause commands that the reliability of evidence be assessed in a particular manner, and that is in the crucible of cross-examination. Colorado courts have long recognized that excessive limitation on cross-examination is a constitutional deprivation. It is a constitutional error, and it is that error that is the common thread among the first issue in my brief, the sequestration order violation, where the court completely precludes defense counsel from exposing the inconsistencies between the witnesses' testimonies in the in-camera hearing and from exposing the false testimony of the victim to the jury. It is the threat of error in the second issue, which I'm calling the Mason discovery issue, where the prosecutor's conduct in failing to reveal the notes of the witness who was on the stand until during her cross-examination wholly deprived defense counsel of his ability to prepare and effectively execute cross-examination of that witness. And it also is a common thread in the fourth issue in my brief, which I don't know that I'll get much time to spend on, but I'm going to mainly focus on the court's preclusion of any impeachment with the false report to police, which the court had already ruled admissible.
Let me back you up then, Ms. Frere, if I can, and take one of those issues at a time. And I think my concern on the, really at least the first two, are prejudice.
Yes.
And I'd appreciate if you would address those. So on the sequestration sanction, I understand the argument that you're making, but it wasn't 100% clear to me what additional impeachment here would have added. The court, as you, I know you know, when you cited the case, is talking about here the different options the court has on sanctions. One is allowing impeachment. One is to give an instruction. The court gave a very strong instruction in this case to say, basically, this woman made a deliberate violation of the sequestration order, and you can consider that against her credibility. It's not 100% clear to me what additional impeachment would have added. I think the judge put a pretty good hole in her.
Well, I think, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think that instruction created the false impression that this witness, or that this witness admitted violating the sequestration order outside the presence of the jury. The prejudice question in a confrontation clause situation is discussed at length by Justice Malarkey in the Merrick case. And the focus is on the witness. And the question for prejudice is whether a reasonable jury's impression of that witness's credibility would have been different had the cross-examination been allowed. So the question here is, would the jury have had a different impression of the victim's credibility if it had been instructed that despite denying under oath 15 minutes before that there was any violation, the court found a deliberate violation? I think the answer to that question is yes.
But Ms. Frere, how would the jury have had a significantly different impression of that witness given the court's oral instruction that the witness had deliberately violated the sequestration order?
Well, I think that had the court allowed cross-examination, the jury would have seen for itself that this witness was denying any misconduct while her partner was admitting it in the same hearing. It would have been exposed to the jury the degree that these two would go to protect themselves. And if the jury had heard the victim coordinator's testimony, which was different from these two, the jury's impression of all of their credibility would have been different. I think if the court had permitted cross-examination, the court would not have been needed to say, I'm finding that she deliberately violated it. That would have been for the jury to assess.
Well, Ms. Frere, since it is an abuse of discretion standard, the court, that would mean that the court would have quite a bit of options in choosing which sanction it felt would be appropriate.
Correct.
So even assuming that your preferred sanction, cross-examination, would have given the jury some different perception of the victim's credibility, how do we find an abuse of discretion, considering that that's such a broad standard, in favor of the trial court?
Well, in the context, again, it's back to the standard of review that's discussed in the Merritt case, which discusses the Van Arsdale case. And you don't even get to an abuse of discretion analysis unless there has not been an infringement on the right of cross-examination. So if a defendant establishes constitutional error when he can show that he was deprived of appropriate cross-examination designed to expose the bias, motives, prejudices of a witness. And I think the victim's untruthfulness during this hearing, this was not a close case. I mean, this was not an overwhelming evidence of guilt case. This was very close. The jury struggled with her credibility. That is evident in the instructions. And the prosecutor said, why don't we allow cross-examination on this? The prosecutor cited the PRG case. Cross-examination was viewed, I think, by this court, by other courts, as being one of the lesser sanctions. But the instruction was misleading. It created this false impression that this witness admitted violating the order, when in fact it wasn't true. This witness denied the conduct, and the jury should have been able to assess her credibility within the context of the other witnesses who testified, Maldonado, her partner. The defendant's sister wasn't permitted to testify. So I think that's where the court abused its discretion. It knew of cases. It had the prosecutor saying this was the sanction. And
so is it your position that if cross-examination is one of the available sanctions, that basically overrides other sanctions that the court might choose to?
No. No, I think it all depends on the circumstances. But it was, the court was aware that this was going to be a close call. All right, the physical evidence in the case didn't support consent or non-consent. The victim's credibility was at issue, and it had always been at issue. This whole idea of the witnesses talking about their statements was recognized by the court at the motions hearing 6 months earlier, when the court said, I'm not going to allow a deposition. I'm really afraid there's going to be some tailoring of testimony here. So this isn't something that was new. So I think that defense counsel's inability to show the jury that this witness denied doing anything wrong within an hour of the conduct occurring, the jury was entitled to see how she described that, what she said, what her demeanor was, how she appeared, and be able not only to compare that to Winter's testimony about that same incident, but the jury was entitled to see how that compared to her description of the incident in this case, where she couldn't remember the details of the assault, where she couldn't remember what happened after the assault. And the jury's question showed that was a concern of theirs. They were asking her, how did your clothes get back on? How did you get back into the front seat? And she couldn't remember. The other jury question was asking, well, you said you were an emotional wreck. Could that have impacted how your ability to not remember these details of the assault? So I do. I think in this context, in every context, no, every case is different. And the judge has to look at how do we remedy this violation. And it was deliberate, so I think it was pretty bad. Moving on to the second issue, the discovery violation, which I think actually is worse. And I think either of these issues merits reversal on its own, but together, absolutely, that merits reversal. I do not think that the court can reconcile, or I could not reconcile, based on the record here, that there was a lack of candor by the prosecutor and not a discovery violation. I don't understand that. There were multiple times where there was a lack of candor, not just in failing to disclose the existence of the notes that went with this email, but then agreeing to stipulate for impeachment purposes that this was what the witness said. The prosecutor was representing to defense counsel, this is what the witness said in my email. She was representing to the court, this is what the witness said. And defense counsel relied on that in preparing his cross-examination. The court relied on that representation in quashing the prosecutor's subpoena. Everybody knew this was a key interview. This witness changed her characterization of her observations of my client and the victim in the 5 hours preceding this incident. She was a prosecution witness.
Can you talk about that? I'm sorry, Ms. Ray, I didn't mean to interrupt you. If I can ask you to address that, and I have concerns about the prosecutor's conduct, and I know poor Mr. Michaels has to stand here and defend it. I don't get how a prosecutor in the middle of cross-examination says, oh, here are the notes after fighting. That's mind-boggling to me, and I'm troubled by it. But I am a little concerned about on the prejudice piece here. What was, I know you say that her testimony changed, and I'll just say and push back. I'm not seeing how it was so dramatically different. She's, you know, she wasn't sure. They seemed to be together. Maybe it was a little more affirmatively. I thought they were together than when she testified at trial. But ultimately, oh, they could have been a couple. I wasn't sure. I didn't see him kissing. It seemed to me the defense was still able to argue from that witness's testimony what it wanted to argue, that there was a chance that this was consensual. So if you can maybe focus me on what you see as that made such a big difference.
Well, I think, first of all, the importance of this witness. She was the second witness called by the prosecutor. She was the only independent witness that didn't have a real motive for doing anything other than stating what she observed. I think from the email and from the notes, it's clear that from the time she spoke with the police until the time she gave the interview to the prosecution, she had learned that this was a sex assault case and that the victim was gay, okay? Defense counsel didn't know information in the notes, clutching onto the waitress. That wasn't anywhere in the email. That's kind of an important thing. If you're going to, he prepared his cross-examination based upon what was in the email. That was not in the email. You know, they were in a close hug. He may have been holding her up. That is a huge, significant difference. Whether he was holding her up or whether she was consenting to hugging him, which is what she told the detective, a day after this incident, that's a huge difference. I mean, I think defense counsel articulated the prejudice as best he could. He cited the In Re Attorney C case, which I don't cite in my briefs. That's a disciplinary opinion involving a prosecutor. He says the only reasonable sanction here is to dismiss this case. And this court has upheld that sanction in the Albarico case that I cited in my brief, where the facts are very, very similar to what happened here. If this had not been an independent witness, if this had been the same nurse, if this had been the nurse at Waldenburg, and we were suddenly getting notes where the physical evidence just didn't really tip the scales one way or the other, okay, there wouldn't be the same amount of prejudice as with this witness who completely changed her testimony. The court's allowing the tape to be played didn't address counsel's inability to cross-examine on that interview with the prosecutor. That's the prejudice. He was never able to fully develop what happened in that interview when her observations changed 180 degrees.
But didn't playing the tape give the jury a chance to see how the witness's testimony had changed?
Sure, but he would have been able to do that anyways. That was impeachment with a prior inconsistent statement. So I don't think that that remedied, again, that didn't remedy what happened during that interview with the prosecutor. It showed the jury what happened with the detective, but that was going to come in irrespective of him being handed the notes during cross-examination and being told at that time, these are the words of the witness. She had already represented that email was the word of the witness when she stipulated to using that email for impeachment purposes. So I see I only have a minute left. I would reserve my remaining
Absolutely.
Argument for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Frary. Mr. Michaels?
Good morning, Your Honors. Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403, here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I too would like to focus on the first two issues, and I think I'll start with the second one and pick up where opposing counsel left off, because I understand this court has a few questions about it. There are two very broad reasons to affirm this ground. The first is that the defense counsel was simply not entitled to the prosecutor's notes at all. And the second is that even if there was error in not disclosing those notes before the prosecutor did, the error was incredibly minimal in terms of the content of the notes, and the sanction imposed by the court far outweighed any harm that the late disclosure would have imparted. To the first point of that, the defense counsel not being entitled, People versus District Court pretty much controls the entire analysis here. And I cited in my brief, the site of it escapes me, but it was reaffirmed very recently in 2012 or 2011 in the Supreme Court's opinion in People versus, I'm going to butcher this name, Vlasis. Anyway, butchered. But the whole idea is that under Criminal Rules of Procedure 16, Part 1, A1, which is, governs mandatory disclosures, the only thing that is a mandatory disclosure is a witness statement that comes as a result of a police report or defense report or an arrest report. That clearly doesn't apply here. So then we move on to Part 1, Sub A, Sub 2, which talks about material that essentially would fall under the idea of Brady versus Maryland, exculpatory in nature. Now, District Court does talk about how impeachment evidence can be exculpatory in nature. But it emphasizes that the impeachment has to be material. You can't just impeach willy-nilly and be entitled to automatic disclosure under A2 if it's simply cumulative or something that has already been disclosed or is capable of being disclosed based on what's already given. And that's what we have here. We're not talking about a material difference between the email and the prosecutor's notes. In fact, what we're talking about is the prosecutor's notes, which were never intended to be direct quotations or direct summaries so much as this is what we talked about. And what we talked about sufficiently notified defense counsel, hey, look, this witness may have changed her story some. And in fact, defense counsel during cross-examination talked about that change and impeached her on that change, saying, well, you were talking about how you were worried about the amount of alcohol you might have served them, so you might have lied to police officers. That was information that came out of that email.
Mr. Michael, let me interrupt you. I have a couple of factual questions.
Sure.
First, I think in your brief you had said that the notes were provided before cross, but Ms. Frayray says no, it was in the middle of cross. Could you help me clarify? I mean, I think it was in the middle.
As I'm sure you know at this point, having read the record, it's kind of a mess all over the place. And Ms. Frayray is more correct than I am in this case. It was delivered at some point during cross-examination. It appears, although the record doesn't specifically reflect where it happened, it appears that it happened when the defense counsel was attempting to pigeonhole the witness into saying, you said fudged, and she said, I wouldn't say fudged, and then it seems like somewhere in there the prosecutor said, I don't think she said fudge, I think that's my summary. But
so why would the prosecutor then give the notes? I mean, the prosecutor's, and this is just one of those, and I hope you guys sometimes talk to the line DAs, it seemed like we shouldn't be here. They should have just given the notes. What was the problem? And it just makes it look very awkward, and it creates an appellate issue. When in the middle of a cross-examination, the prosecutor says, oh, here, to defense lawyer, that strikes a tone of unfairness. I understand your argument that you didn't have to produce it. It sure looks and feels pretty bad. So what was the reason the prosecutor turns it over then, having thought about producing it before? I mean, it seems like and I'm reading between the lines, and I'd like your spin here. But it just seems to me like the prosecutor realized, well, there's something here that's useful to a defense lawyer, maybe for impeachment, and I should turn it over. That would suggest Brady material to me. Push back, but I'm just having trouble understanding.
Sure.
Obviously, I'm troubled by it. Prejudice is a different issue.
Sure, and I'll talk about prejudice in a second.
Right.
To answer your first concern, yeah, it looks bad. But no, that doesn't make it error, because in the first place, again, and I won't dwell on this because I know you're not interested in this so much, it wasn't required to give over in the first place. The email represented a summarization of the interview, which is all that's required under A1 and A2 in order to disclose. The notes itself were the prosecutor's own notes, and under, I believe it's Ortega and even Alberico, they talk about anything that talks about your own conclusions, your own theories, your own understanding of an argument, that's work product. That gets kept for the prosecutor.
Now, was there any of that? I'm sorry to interrupt you,
because
I was gasping at that point. Was there any mental impressions in these notes? It wasn't clear to me that there were. But, you know,
I think that's a gray area. I think probably the better course of action in this case would have been to say, hey, trial court, I want you to look this over because I think this would work product. I do think that would have been the better option. It didn't happen, but under 16A2 and under district court, the first cut of understanding whether or not a material is exculpatory is the prosecutor's belief. And if that prosecutor's belief isn't met, or the prosecutor believes, hey, this isn't exculpatory, or here, where the prosecutor said, hey, I've delivered all the exculpatory material from this interview to you, so you have it all, and you're able to cross-examine this witness, then there's no error until the defense counsel says, wait a minute, there was exculpatory material. And defense counsel said, wait a minute, there was exculpatory material when they got the notes. And then the trial court evaluated the notes and said, you know what, it's within my judgment call to say, no, this wasn't exculpatory material, this wasn't subject to Brady. And that's what the trial court did, and it made proper findings about that. In answer to the very beginning of your question, and I'm going to try to paraphrase this as I can remember, it's been a few minutes now. You asked, why did the prosecutor give the notes in the middle of cross-examination? And I think it's because the defense counsel was stuck on this word fudge, which the defense counsel spent a lot of time, and I know you've looked at the cross-examination, I urge you to do it again, spent a lot of time trying to back this witness into saying, why did you fudge this? Why did you fudge this? Why did you fudge the amount of alcohol you originally said you gave them? And the witness said, I don't use that word. That's not my word, fudge. And the prosecutor's like, okay, that's the word I used in the email, but I never used quotation marks. I never said it was a direct quote from the witness, and he's trying to lock this witness down into a word that this witness just didn't use. And so I think, frankly, reading between the lines, I think it's the prosecutor trying to say, you don't want to bark up this tree. It's more of a sideshow taking over the surface than anything else.
So, Mr. Michaels, does the use of the word fudge in the prosecutor's notes make that statement one that has attorney work product?
I think arguably yes. But regardless, the prosecutor disclosed that and said, the connotation that the prosecutor was trying to suggest was this witness was downplaying her potential involvement because she thought she might be in trouble. So she fudged it, she changed the number, she downplayed the number in order to make herself look better. And that's impeachment material. And that's something that I have to give to the defense counsel so the defense counsel can go after the witness on that ground of lying to the police or misrepresenting the police in the first instance.
Right. My sense is that Ms. Frayray's concern here is not whether or not the material should have been disclosed in the first place, but rather the discrepancy between the contents of the email and the contents of the prosecutor's notes.
Sure. To address that, there are two sort of prongs to this. The first prong is that the subjective discrepancy didn't exist. There was no significant difference between the prosecutor's notes and the email. The thrust of the email was, here's what the witness said to us. There's a point where she downplayed her involvement. That's all that was needed as a substantive matter. Now, the second prong of that is the one that I think is concerning to opposing counsel, and that's where the prosecutor didn't say, the victim was potentially clutching onto the waitress, I believe was the terminology, or he, being the defendant, was holding up the victim instead of bear hugging. But here's the problem with that. That evidence never came in. That evidence was never introduced. There's no prejudice of saying, okay, now, Miss Waitress, did you see, the prosecutor never asked, did you see the defendant holding up the victim? Or did you see the victim holding on to the waitress? None of that came in. And there's no colorable claim that the defense counsel is going to get up there and say, now, in your original interview, you said they weren't really a couple, but you couldn't really tell. They seemed couple-like and they got friendlier at night. That's entirely consistent with what she told the prosecutor. What defense counsel wasn't going to do is get up there and say, now, the other day, you told the prosecutor that she was so drunk that the defendant was holding her up before he took her away. There's not a chance he's going to impeach her on that because it's better left out. As a matter of trial strategy, you're not going to say, these statements that you told the prosecutor, that the prosecutor hasn't brought into trial, they look bad for my client, but they also impeach your credibility a little bit. That's not really the issue that we have to address. And so the issue we have to look at is this prejudice component. And we go back to what was introduced, what what the trial court did to remedy anything. And first of all, let's look at the cross-examination. defense counsel got at exactly what he wanted to get in with this witness. He got her to admit, I fudged or did give a conservative number. He didn't get the magic word fudge. I understand that. But that was never a quote that he was entitled to get in. That's just something that he fixated on. I got the witness to say, I minimize my culpability. So that's one. He also got an instruction saying the prosecutor just revealed this note, which again, my position is that the prosecutor was never required to give that note under A2 or D1, and certainly under 16(1)(E1), the work product doctrine. The defense counsel got an instruction saying, prosecutor stipulated to this email that said this. The prosecutor then gave some notes that said something somewhat contradictory. They didn't go into the details of it because defense counsel specifically said, I don't want to go into the details of it because I don't know what I can confirm or deny. But he got an instruction basically saying, the prosecution is not being particularly credible here, which was significantly more than the defense was entitled to. And on top of that, he got to play the original DVD interview with the witness and what she said immediately to the police upon that. And if that's not the best evidence of her credibility and her character and her truthfulness on the stand, as well as the underlying substance, then there's nothing that could have possibly remedied it. And finally, again, it was an effective cross. Defense counsel could have called this witness for himself. He could have interviewed this witness for himself separately. And that's another problem that you have to consider under 16(d)(1) when we talk about discretionary disclosures. 16(d)(1) talks about two things: whether it was reasonable, the request for the prosecutor's notes was reasonable, and whether it was relevant. It wasn't relevant in that it had already been revealed by the email. But more importantly, it wasn't reasonable because he could have gotten that very same information by talking to the waitress himself. And that's something that district court and Vlasis really emphasizes. You have to have that reasonableness aspect wherein the information cannot have come from any other source but the prosecution. And if he talked to the waitress, he would have had that exact same information. So it fails both prongs under the discretionary disclosure, too. Regarding Alvarico, it was significantly more extreme of a violation than anything here. We're talking about, in Alvarico, the notes of striking a victim's statement where the prosecution hadn't actually released notes of its own interview with the victim. Here we're talking about a subsidiary witness where the prosecution materially released those notes. Nothing was particularly contradictory in the notes. I have 2 minutes left. I would love to touch on the first issue, but I don't want to leave you with any questions on the second or third or fourth, for that matter. So unless there are any questions.
Go for it.
All right. I'm going to talk very quickly about this. Boy, these sequestration violations were very minimal. We have a witness who says, I heard them talking. She said, I heard them say, and then heard nothing else. And then another witness said, she heard them walking along the river and talking about, they said the word march, and she heard nothing else. Everything else is pure speculation. And what the trial court still got was, or what the defense counsel still got was a credibility instruction directly refuting any prejudice that possibly could have come. It said, and this is, mind you, after 4 hours of cross-examining cross-examining the victim in this case, in which he got the victim to announce, I had a hard time remembering things, it was troubling. And he said, look, this victim's credibility is in question. You have to consider that, this victim's specific credibility. He also got to cross-examine Ms. Maldonado about what she heard. And later on in the partner's testimony, which is on the next day on 10/13, at the very end of cross-examination, he got to ask her about the sequestration violation as well. And that's something that I think escaped in the brief, but at the very end of cross-examination. And I'll take it that you know the partner's name, so I don't mention that in this court. But the crux here is there was no involvement of the prosecutor, absolutely none. And that's one of the biggest keys. The second is that the actions were minimal and largely inadvertent. They left the courtroom, they saw the defendant and defense counsel, they left. They talked about dates they were broken up, which happened 2 years after trial. My time's up.
Can you finish your sentence?
The dates that they talked about that they were broken up happened 2 years after the rape occurred. And they were basically contextual, oh, well, this is what happened. Defense counsel was mean. So the prejudice is very minimal compared to the sanction that was imposed. So I would ask that you affirm for all those reasons.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels.
Thank you.
Ms. Ferrer, you've got a minute and 4 seconds.
Thank you, Judge. I'll talk fast. I want to first address the AG's argument about the difference between the notes and the email not being, that there not wasn't a difference. The court made inconsistent findings. The first time the court said there were real differences. The next day, the court said any differences were de minimis. That was for the jury to determine. The only reason that counsel didn't bring in clutching of the waitress or holding up the witness is because he didn't know about them. His strategy in cross-examination might have been completely different, and he might have marched this witness through every single inconsistency between what she told the police, what was in the email, and what was in the notes. Those were three different statements. Regarding the sequestration order violation, it's true that the judge changed her ruling with the partner and said, yes, it's just a natural flow from the sequestration order violation, but it was meaningless when the jury had nothing to compare it to in terms of the victim's explanation. And he sought to recall the victim, and the court said no. So based on the violations in this case, I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Aiken's conviction, and I would ask the court to consider just dismissing this case under Albarico for the violations in Issue 2. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ferrer. The court thanks both you and Mr. Michaels. The arguments here were excellent, obviously very well prepared, and very helpful to the court, and we very much appreciate it. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel, you're excused.